Hello, and thank you for downloading Wax Lyrical, the scale-up marketing podcast from Wax On and the Marketing Society. And I'm Mark Ranicus.
And I'm Harry Neal. Today's podcast guest is Mike Stevens, serial founder, consultant, and writer on all things consumer goods, startups, and direct-to-consumer marketing. Hello, and welcome to Wax Lyrical, Mike. Thanks for joining us.
All right, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Before we get to talking about your journey as a founder and the book you've been writing, which we're both very excited to hear more about, could you give us a little bit of an introduction to you and your background?
The best way to describe me as probably as a startup guy. I'd love being in sort of the startup businesses, sort of new endeavors and trying to sort of grow them into proper things. For most of my career, I've been in food and drink. And the two brands that I'm most associated with is Innocent, the smoothie brand. I was on the startup team there. And after a good number of years there, I left and started my own brand. I co-founded a confectionery company called Peppersmith, which I sort of started, scaled and sold eventually a few years ago. And since then, I've been sort of doing lots of different things, including writing a book on D2C brands.
Which we'll come back to in a minute. So I hope you don't mind a bit like the famous rock star going back to the seminal album, which in your case is the Innocent album. Can we just go back there a little bit? And, you know, what was it like? I guess because so many founders look up to Innocent these days and kind of go, I want to be like that.
Yeah, I've so much. I mean, the reason I was there for such a long time, I was there for 8 years because it was just such a brilliant place to be where new stuff was happening all the time, new challenges were there. I mean, many good things, like we're going to move this business on every month, every year that happened. So, I mean, I learned everything from, there was my bit of the business, which was supply chain. But at the same time, I was heavily involved in sort of sales and marketing, people management, scaling business, tech side of things in terms of, moving from, scrappy systems into sort of, more robust, proper business systems. Yeah, I was either involved in all of that stuff or certainly, was observing. It was one of the things, I'm a generalist because I'm just, immensely curious about lots of different things. And, in a business like Innocent where so much was going on, I just had the opportunity to see all this stuff and get involved firsthand, which is I'll always be grateful for. And I guess it's, my big advantage that I had access to that from an early stage, and I've been thinking about that stuff 20 years. So I guess that was the sort of the biggest thing I learned, which was the quick answer is everything. But the second thing I would say, which I think is really important, I was lucky to work for three founders who were just incredibly smart about what they did. And I've got a theory that most businesses would generally survive as long as they've got good products and I guess the founder and the management team probably get 70 or 80% of the decisions correct. At Innocent, it seemed like, I wouldn't say everything was right, but probably 95, 96, 97% of the decisions that were made were all good ones. And it was so good for me to see not only what those decisions were, but it was about how you make those decisions. How do you evaluate what you should do next?
Do you think there was something unique then that empowered you all to make the right decision? Because, when we talk to founders, we hear a lot about you learn from your mistakes. Don't be afraid to make a decision. Don't be afraid to make a strategy. Any strategy is better than no strategy, all that kind of stuff. So if they were right first time, most of the time, how do you think they did that?
Just by being just incredibly smart. I think, the Innocent team or the founders, where they are sort of freaks, but in a very good way. In terms of, they're a team of three guys, and you've got the ops guy who's very logical and numerate. You've got the sales guy who's very, very sort of charismatic and knows how to get on with people and, sort of into the numbers as well. And the branding guy who sort of sets the scene when it comes to, trying to communicate what the business is all about. And those three together, they were like one super brain. It was hard. I mean, I made so many more mistakes when I went on to found my own business. So I think I've been lucky that I've seen, this is how you do it, even when you make all the right moves. And then doing it myself, I managed to take some of those learnings into, I know what I'm doing. And then some of the things that I didn't quite get right, it was good to learn firsthand. This is not always going to go to plan.
Well, let's move a bit forward. As you say, let's not stick with that first album. Let's go to the big album then, the Peppersmith album, continuing the musical metaphor. Tell us a bit about that, how you had the idea, how you kind of got the nerve to break away from Innocent, because it must have been quite a nice job to break away from that and to do your own thing. Tell us that story.
Yeah, this is the solo album, right?
Solo album, absolutely, yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, as I said, it was always a matter of when, not if, I did my own thing. I mean, I joined Innocent with, you know, having, yeah, I need to start my own business in mind right from the get-go. So it was really when that was going to happen. And it got, the point when it happened was this point where the business was getting a bit more, you know, it was bigger and more, not more serious, but more specialised. So it was time for me to step away. So I co-founded Peppersmith, which was a natural confectionery brand, with another chap that I met at Innocent called Dan Shrimpton. And yeah, I guess the big idea was we were going to take all the learnings around products and brands that we'd learned at Innocent and take it into a different category, which is confectionery. And the reason we did confectionery, because confectionery had had just been left behind. I mean, there were all these trends which are still going on today about being natural, more healthy, more sustainable, and a brand to tell the story to the consumers, you know, what the product was all about. And in the world of confectionery, it was the same old brands that had been around for, you know, dozens, if not hundreds of years, and they were all unhealthy, mass market, you know, very, very cheaply made. And we thought there was an opportunity to do something different in that category, similar to what we've seen before. So that was the idea going into it. And, you know, I'd say anyone who knows the Peppersmith brand, we were largely proved correct in terms of there is a space for a more natural, healthy product. However, it was a lot tougher than we anticipated. You know, going through all that success at Innocent, you sort of think, oh, this is not going to be easy, but you sort of, you know, let's just do the same things again. But it's, you know, it's a different product, a different set of customers, and a different time. So it was definitely quite hard. And our biggest learnings was, you know, the consumer. I think the consumer wanted the product, but the people didn't seem to be that interested in it. It was actually the retailers. And it's one of the reasons I'm so heavily invested in direct to consumer. I love being able to serve the product, the people with the products who want those products. You know, it's just a great way to get the product from you to them. What I didn't enjoy was the retailers being the gatekeeper. And they don't always get the decisions right. And also in the time, I guess, you know, when the Peppersmith adventure was happening from like 2010 through to now, but in the last decade, I think everyone knows this, the retail industry, especially the grocers, have come under a lot more pressure, you know, primarily to make money. They used to be, you know, look at Tesco, this huge business that, you know, it could churn out the profits. And then about 10 years ago, that changed. You know, they're businesses that are still big, but they're really struggling to actually, make sure the bottom line's healthy. And what that means to, I guess, to challenge your brands to new products, it's a lot harder to get your products on shelf. And I found that. I found that quite disheartening at times. And we did a good job with Peppersmith. We're in, you know, we got into, and we're still in Sainsbury's and Waitrose and Morrison's and Holland & Barrett, you know, some of these big retailers. But man, it was such a grind to actually get the products onto shelf.
So now we know a little bit more about you and your journey and kind of where, what's gotten you to where you are now. It's probably worth us now talking about the book and discussing that. I know you've been writing it over, I think it's the last year when we spoke to you before. You told us about the last year or so. So the direct to consumer playbook. First, and obviously probably the most obvious question: what is it, and what is the idea behind it?
So the direct to consumer playbook is a book for founders and potential founders and for businesses and brands who want to sell their stuff online direct to consumer. I mean, it sounds pretty obvious, and they think, oh, isn't everyone doing that? And the answer is yes, everyone is doing it. However, it's still such a new thing. There's not a lot of best practice out there. And we found this at Peppersmith. So, you know, just to sort of, how, you know, the Peppersmith story, we started the business in 2010. We sort of scaled it up through through those years. And we had our ups and downs, but generally it was a successful business. And one of the things that we really wanted to do more of as we grew was to do more D2C. And the reason we wanted to do more D2C is because we really, primarily, first and foremost, love the connection with the end consumer. You just don't get that if you sell your stuff in the shops. You don't know who's buying your products. So it was just great to be able to have that connection and make sure we could serve the people who liked our products best in the best possible way. So we really enjoyed that. However, you know, there's so many things you have to do when you do direct consumer. Yeah, you have to have the tech, you have to have the supply chain, you have to do the marketing, you have to do the customer service. It all felt like, you know, this was quite difficult, and we weren't sure if we were doing the right thing. And then as I sort of was talking to my, you know, my peer group of other founders who were also trying to do more D2C, it became apparent that we were all just learning on the job. And so this was probably 2015, 2016. And I said, look, you know, if I really want to buy the book, can someone just tell me what to do? No, I'm sort of got, I like reading a lot of books. So it's like, come on, let me just read the book and find how it's done. And sure enough, the book wasn't there. And I said back then, it's like, oh man, if no one's going to write this book, I'm going to do it. And then what happened? A few things happened at Peppersmith. We were up for a funding round that turned into an acquisition round, and we sold the business in 2018. And I eventually exited the business completely in the summer of 2019. And no one had still written this sodding book. So yeah, it's like the world still needs this book. You know, my fellow founders out there still, you know, could really benefit from this. No one's written this book. I need to write it. So I've been sort of, I was dabbling for probably the first 6 months into end of 2019 into 2020. But since the start of last year, I've been interviewing the best founders I can find to do two things, to hear their founding story, and also to pull out what are the lessons around D2C that everyone should take notice of. And, you know, the primary focus of the book, it's about learning, it's about education. But what I really hope it does, it provides inspiration for the next generation of founders who have got great products and they want to find a way to get them to the customers.
What will I have taken away from it when I've read the book, do you think, Mike?
Well, you're going to take away... a dozen or more fantastic startup stories. Anyone who likes business likes, you know, sort of to hear the journey. You know, how did, you know, from an idea probably around a kitchen table in terms of a multi-million business, you know, what happened between A and B? I certainly tell their stories, but the most important thing from those great stories is to pull out what are those core lessons for D2C businesses. And, you know, the commonalities always around, you know, this is what we did right in terms of marketing. This is how we controlled, you know, sort of acquisition costs. This is how we treat our customers with customer service. This is how we thought about margins. This is how we looked at our technology and how our tech stack changed. You know, you can get quite into the detail, but it's not about the detail. It's about the fundamentals, because what I hope this book will do, if we can focus on those fundamental things that you should be doing, if someone reads this book in 10 years time, it's still going to be helpful. Because what I don't want to do is write the sort of book where, oh yeah, the right thing to do is plow all your money into influencers and Instagram ads and you're gonna, you know, that's the best way to get return. Because in 2 years time, those rules are going to change. Those platforms are going to change. There will be just to be a different set of things you have to do. So what I want to do is make sure you understand what are the primary drivers of the things you need to do to make your business successful. So, you know, to answer your question, you know, if what you want to come out the other side with is like, oh, now I've read the book. Now I think I know what I'm doing, and I can start my own D2C brand. Just as I, you know, when I was at Innocent, so I learned a lot of things. And then when I started my own business, I think I know what I'm doing. I'm going to make mistakes, but generally, I think I've got the plot here.
You've mentioned that you've obviously got a lot of amazing stories and contributions from founders in your book. Some of who actually we've recently had on the podcast, which is nice, kind of hearing their stories firsthand, but then being able to read them once the book comes out. If you do have any, what's your favorite story or interview that you've featured in the book?
There's so many good stories. I mean, I could tell you every brand that I've interviewed, I could say that's the best story because it's so interesting. But just to give you a flavour of the sort of thing in the book, there is a Scottish entrepreneur called Bree Reed, and she's got her brand's called Snag. Maybe you've ever come across it, but essentially it's just better make tights for women and some men. And I think the reason I like that story so much is there's two things. It shows, number one, there's still so many simple problems out there for entrepreneurs to solve. You should never think, oh, the best ideas have already been done. And then secondly, I just loved her. You know, she built her business really successfully. But then when the pandemic hit in sort of March, April 2020, the business got into real trouble because what happened was, you know, sales fell off a cliff while everyone was wondering what the hell was going on. But it meant she was actually, or the business was knee deep into Facebook ads. And all of a sudden they had huge Facebook bills with no revenue coming in to pay them. And so essentially what she did, because the business was really on its knees, is that she crowdfunded the solution from her community. And the answer was to do a promotion, and the business didn't really do promotions, but it wasn't just like 30% off. It was essentially, it was buy one now, get one in 6 months' time. So buy one now, get one later. And with all the money coming up front. And the great thing about that idea, it wasn't an idea from within the business. It was an idea from the community. Their community said, why don't you do this? And they did that campaign, and they went from being sort of 600 grand in the red, you know, without being asked to pay their bills, to having a million plus quid in the bank in a week. And it was just such a good story. And it also, you know, illustrates the power of the community. And most of the DTC brands I'm interviewing, especially the ones who've been founded in the last 3 or 4 years, there's a real emphasis on community in terms of, yeah, serving that community, but also the community helping the business grow.
Reflecting then on COVID, and it's difficult to have any decent conversation with a businessman or a businesswoman at the moment and it not coming up in conversation. Looking forward, how positive do you see the D2C horizon post-COVID?
So what I'm really seeing now is D2C being a starting point for a lot of brands, because it's the best way to test the market. As I said, you've got no retail buyer sort of telling you either that your product's not right for being in their store, or what often happens, them telling you is like, your product might be right, but you're not going to be able to pay my promotion fees, so therefore you're not going to be in store. So you can test that. You know, you can test your, the market with your product to see, you know, can you build a following? Is it actually useful to people? Can you make sure that it's actually worthwhile doing what you're doing? And I think, you know, if brands start that way, use D2C as their platform to do it, because there's no reason, you know, there's nothing stopping you doing that. And then you can prove your worth. And if it is working, you've got the choice. You can either be exclusively D2C because you think that's the best way to serve your customers, or you can, you know, have more of an omni-channel model, which is what, you know, most D2C brands do, which is actually go and find your customers where they are. And that might be in shops, it might be in restaurants, it could be in gyms or wherever it is, but it's away from your phone or your laptop.
As we said right at the beginning of the episode, you're a serial entrepreneur, a serial founder, and have been a consultant to many different kind of startup and scale up businesses, as well as being an author with a book coming out. What would you say is the kind of most important characteristics of being a successful founder?
Yeah, it has to be a calling. And if it's not a calling, it's just a crazy thing to do. I mean, it's a lot of hassle, it's a lot of grief, and you're probably not going to get rich. It's so much better, or such a safer bet, to have a normal job. Go and work, you know, by all means, go and work for a business that you can connect to and you believe in the mission. But to start your own business as a founder, it's a bad bet. So you've got to have other reasons for doing it. And for me, I think, you know, in terms of the, if you want to be a founder, First and foremost, go and work in a startup to see if you really know what you're getting yourself into. And if the answer is still, yes, I absolutely want to do this, just make sure, I guess, you've got the mental and physical resilience to be able to build a business. It's really, really tough and things are going to go wrong. And the phrase that I like to use for, you know, for good founders is to be a pragmatic optimist. And what I mean by that is, you know, you have to be optimistic and believe that, you know, there's going to be a good outcome. You've got to back yourself, but you've also not got to be crazy about that. You've got to understand the problems and you've got to understand the way you solve them. If it looks like you can't solve, you know, if it looks like you're trying to do something that's impossible, it probably is impossible to do something that you actually think you can do.
As you say, things do go wrong. And I personally do believe that failure is okay. Embrace it and learn from it. And I wonder, either in your own experience, how would you advise founders to deal with it? And I'm also interested to understand how you deal with it for those around you, because there is a bit of a kind of a myth that the founder is completely indefatigable and will always rebound from every setback. And, you know, we are human beings at the end of the day. So what about when things go wrong? How do you deal with it with the rest of the team? And have you got a favorite story, either of your own or from the founders that you've interviewed?
I think as a founder, you've got to be, well, two things. You've got to be prepared to fail. Failing's okay. You try not to, but, you know, you have to, you know, to succeed, you're going to have to fail along the way. But, you know, and secondly, I think it's being kind to yourself and all around you. When things go wrong, you have to be forgiving. If it's a decision you've made, you've got to be kind to yourself, and or a decision that your team's made and has caused you a problem. You've got to be kind to them and kind to yourself. You've got to take responsibility for it. So you might as well, you know, be accepting, make sure you can learn from it. But yeah, just don't beat yourself up. I mean, yeah, being a founder, the world is beating you up all the time. So don't beat yourself up. And in terms of, you know, a story about being a founder, we went through some real ups and downs at Peppersmith. We had some successes, and there was definitely a few times where things was not going at all well. I mean, we did get to the point after the Brexit vote, actually, where we had some exchange rate issues because, you know, we sourced all our products from the EU. And then when the Brexit vote happened, the currency or the pound plunged against the euro. And that meant we went from a profitable business to not a profitable business. And that was really tough. And that, you know, that went on for quite a while, to the point where it looked like we actually might go out of business. And, you know, I remember at that time, not only, you know, did I start to talk to our accountants and advisors and stuff. It's like, you know, if this continues on this trend, we're going to run out of money. What happens then? And it was really enlightening. It's like, well, you know, this is what happens when you go into administration, which most people don't like to think of. And it was like, it was really good for me to actually learn what that process was without going into it, but doing it early enough where I still had control. And the second thing that I look back on those days, I was actually seeing a business coach. You know, there's a business coach I was using. So I'm going through this really tough time. How should I be managing sort of myself and my decision making? And his advice was actually at the time was, well, Mike, looks like things are not going to work out. You might as well move on. Yeah, and prepare yourself for that. And I was like, well, that does make sense. But yeah, that's what it's going back to, sort of backing yourself and being a pragmatic optimist. It's like, that might happen, but there's still a few things we can try. And what I don't want to do is let the ship go down without sort of just trying some sensible, logical things to see if I can turn it around. And yeah, the good news was, you know, I did turn it around. We went from the business where we were losing money to making money again, and eventually found a path to exit. And that was really positive, because, you know, I was prepared for all things. I knew what was going to happen if it didn't work out, so I was prepared for that. But also, you know, I hadn't quite given up yet. And that was really tough, because, you know, I had on my wife, I've got a young family, and, you know, she was looking at me and saying, Mike, if this not working, should you be doing something else? And it's like, yeah, you know, this is what happens if it doesn't work, but this is what I'm going to do in the meantime. There's a few more things that we can try. It's not, you know, we've not reached the end of the road yet. But I am pragmatic about it. I know, you know, if it does go wrong, it's okay. And here's what we need to do. So I sorted it out. But the best thing that came out of that experience for me is not only, you know, it was a successful ending. It was a nice end to that story, but it also meant that I was able to get an appreciation in terms of what the most important things are. Because I think a lot of founders have this dream in terms of, you know, what does success look like? Well, success looks like this big novelty check in sort of 5 to 7 years after you found your business and you sell it out and you have millions of pounds and it's all isn't life wonderful and have a good pat on the back. But actually, it wasn't about that. It was about family. It was about friends. It was about lifestyle. It was about, you know, it was about location, and it was about how I spent the day and sort of going through that process and seeing, I guess, success and failure at the same time. I was able to pick out of that, you know, these are the things that if I achieve, I'm going to be happy. And that's exactly what happened. I sold the business. I've moved down to the coast. I'm now trying lots of different things. That was success. What I didn't do is make me lots and lots of money. But you know what? That was also okay. And I don't think I would have had that perspective going into this without going through those experiences.
So as well as writing the book, we know that you've also co-founded Right Founder at the beginning of this year. Could you tell us a little bit more about that and the reasons why you went ahead and did that?
Yeah, so Right Founders, at the moment, I call it a side project. It's a very intense, busy side project, but it's a side project. The reason I've spent time on Right Founder is because it's about co-founder relationships. I mean, I mentioned the innocent co-founders. I had a great co-founder at Peppersmith, Dan. And what I know about having co-founders is that it's such a better way to found a business, because you can share your energy, your ideas, you share in the workload, you share in the mental resilience when the things get tough. And I also think you can make better decisions. You know, two heads are absolutely better than one. Three or four can even be even better too. So, you have to be sensible about that. But, you know, having a co-founder is really critical. However, you're in this really stressful environment where you've got to do lots of different things and there's lots of different challenges. So you need to be with the Right Founder. And so the Right Founder is all about, it's an online coaching app. And, you know, if you're thinking about going into business with someone, what it is designed to do is help you identify, you know, where you're aligned and where you're not, and here are the things you need to focus on, and do that in an automated way. So I guess, you know, there are sort of business coaches and people out there, mentors, advisors, who will be able to help you with that. But this is an online tool where you can make sure that you're in the business with the person who suits the business and suits you. So you can help you evaluate that. But more importantly, beyond that, it just focuses on your relationship in terms of this is how you best manage yourself and this is where you should be focused. So where you focus your energies and importantly, focus your conversations. And if you do that, you're going to build a stronger relationship and a stronger business.
You know what? I've heard several founders say that finding the right people when you're scaling up is the most difficult bit of the scale-up process. And you've been through both, really, through startup and scale-up. And it strikes me they are very different environments. And A, would you agree with that? And sometimes, is it right for the founder to stay on during scale-up? Because I also observe that the right guy or girl for startup might not be the right guy or girl for scale-up.
Yeah, and I think, you know, good founders are very humble when they show humility. And I think if you've got that, you will understand, you know, when the business outgrows your set of skills. I mean, you're completely right. The requirements and the skill set and the behaviors of a founder or a startup business are different from a scale-up, and they're different from an established business. You get some really great founders out there who are able to sort of ride that wave and change and adapt and learn. But there definitely some founders out there who are pretty, you know, better suited to a certain stage. I mean, I don't know if I'd be any good at running a business with hundreds and hundreds of people in there. I've never done that. I'd like to think I'd probably be okay, but who knows till you get there. And what I'd like to think, I have got the, I've got the humility and the common sense to actually know when it's the right time to step down. And I see some really, really good founders who actually change their role. You don't have to leave your business necessarily, but you can definitely change your role and allow sort of the right people to do the right jobs. But it's hard because you have to find people you really trust.
Being a founder is obviously an amazing opportunity to create something new to the world. I know you've kind of spoken a lot about that, about, you know, wanting to bring something new to the category that you're going to be working in. But we obviously know that not everyone gets the opportunity to do that. How important is inclusion within the founder space and getting people from these more diverse backgrounds to be a part of it?
One of the reasons I think there's so many sort of middle class white blokes out there who found businesses is number one, I think there's a sense of entitlement and they believe they can do it. So they've got the confidence just to go out there and let's go and build a business and, you know, it's all going to be great. But more importantly than that, I think they also have the resources and the ability to take a bit of risk. When you found a business, you know, often you don't pay yourself anything for the first couple of years. And for, you know, for 2, 3, 4, 5 years after that, you're paying yourself, you know, a meager salary and knowing that it could all blow up. If you're in a situation where you can't, you know, you have to pay the mortgage, you've got to pay the bills, you can't afford to take the risk of working on something for 2, 3, 4, 5 years and coming out the other side with zero to show for it, you know, you're just not going to start a business. So I think we have to find more ways to give more founders from diverse backgrounds more opportunities and resources and flexibility to go and, you know, to do more things. And a good way, I think, to be able to do that as well is with something we can control. You know, if I look at my peer group and myself, when we found businesses, we should be able to employ more diversity of women in our teams. As I think I've said, it's really good to have diverse people on your team because they help you solve more problems. But secondly, if we've got diverse people on those teams, we're going to be able to you're going to help them gain the experience they need to go out there and solve more problems. Just as I was really lucky at Innocent, where I was able to learn so much in that business. Hopefully by employing, you know, more diverse people, we'll give them the skills, the experience and the confidence to go out there and found more businesses. So yeah, absolutely, we can do that and we should be doing that now and not just looking at, you know, traditional metrics like, you know, what school did you go to and what degree do you get. We've got to start looking at, you know, what skills have you got, how passionate about are you about this? Yeah, how much are you being creative? So you just say you want a marketing role. You know, there's nothing stopping you now having your curating some work on Instagram or wherever, having your own blog, starting your own your own web shop. You know, find those people who are doing those things because they're the people who are going to help the business the most.
Couldn't agree more. And I'm genuinely looking forward to reading the book because by the sound of the way you've described it, I'm going to learn through other people's experiences. And that's fascinating enough, but it's also fascinating because I'm sure I'll get to learn a little bit about the people who I'm learning from. And if we were writing a book and you were in it, we've got a question for you that I'm sure will help people learn a bit about you. And the question is, Mike Stevens, what is your favourite TV ad? And tell us a bit about it.
Yes, I guess this is a good question. It's not it's not something I think about that often. But my favourite TV ad, or the one that springs to mind, is the, remember the Honda advert, the Impossible Dream one. I think it's about 10 years old now, but if you, for those who haven't seen that ad, I'll just remind you what it is. It's about a guy gets up in the morning out of his shack and gets on this little scooter or a moped. And then as he drives away, you see him on his journey. And as he's on his journey, all these amazing vehicles change. And you think he ends up on a rocket or on a plane. So you know, that's an ad. But you know why I love the ad, I mean, first of all, I would say I'm not at all a petrol head. I couldn't really give a hoot about most cars, so it's not about the product, but it is about the cinematography of that ad. I mean, it is an ad where if I ever saw it on TV, I'd stop what I was doing just so I could watch it. Which is a very rare thing. But and the thing I think makes that ad the most is the music. It's an Impossible Dream by Andy Williams, which is just such, it's just a great song, but you've got this music with all this, you know, this imagery and this journey and this really interesting set of stuff going on. And it's just one guy and his vehicles. And at the end, I love it because, you know, if you know Honda, they've got this little robot thing as well, and the robot's there waving at the guy. But it's just the whole thing. And I will compare it to, it's about this life journey. But if you remember, I think, again, probably it was about 10 years ago, it was either an Xbox or a PlayStation advert which showed, you know, sort of Cradle to Grave, and it was about this guy racing through life. It was like, it was a baby, then it was a boy, then it was a man, then it was an old man, and it was dead. And it happened like within a minute, and it was really shocking. It's like, oh man, yeah, you know, because it's easy to think life's like that. But actually, what the Honda ad does, it means that I think it makes life feel like this beautiful journey that you should relish and enjoy being on and take a breath. So I think I just love it. It's just a great piece of art. It's not an advert, it's art. And I love it for that reason.
Put it better myself.
There's two versions of the ad. So the original one is from 2005, and then the extended version, which features the Honda robot,
the remix.
The remix is actually 30 seconds longer. So the original ad's 2 minutes, and then the extended version is 2.5, and it features a load more additional Honda vehicles and innovations that have kind of happened between, you know, that 5 years from that first one to the second one. In total, there is actually 20 Honda products featured in the ad, from the kind of little bike at the beginning all the way up to at the end. He ends the extended version in a hot tub, which is powered by a solar generator produced by Honda. The song itself as well is from created by Andy Williams, but it's actually from a Don Quixote musical called Man of La Mancha, which the song itself actually won the 1965-66 Tony Award for Best Lyrics. So it's been around for a long time.
I don't know.
Musical theatre, exactly. I don't know if it's connected, because the actual product, the first bike which is shown, is from 1966. I don't know if the song is a connection there, but that might just be me clutching at straws. But the to go into another advert, the one you referenced, the games console advert, was Xbox, is when the Xbox was first launched and got banned. So that's another bit of trivia for you. Before we do go, it'd be good to know, when is the book available and where are people going to be able to buy it?
So the book is due to be published in May next year. I've got the deadline looming, and launch date seems a long way off, because there's still a hell of a lot of writing I've got to do. But yes, it should be out. It'll be out in the springtime next year. So keep your eye out for it. But the best thing to do is, if you can track me down on the usual places, on LinkedIn and Twitter, you find me sort of Mike J. Stevens on LinkedIn, Open Mike Stevens on Twitter. If you want to know more about it, absolutely happy to chat about it anytime, and I'll be letting people know when it's out, and yeah, hopefully it'll be useful.
Thank you for listening to Wax Lyrical, the scale up and change up marketing podcast from Wax On. Wax On are advertising and branding experts for scale up businesses, helping you grow famously. Find out more at wearewaxon.com.